for exports and, your import coverage, it's the amount of reserves you've got paid for imports, and gross national product. And we look at all those, and the country performing the best, we get a score of 100, and then on a weighted basis, we score the other countries, just to see how each country is performing relative to another. In consumer price index, West Germany is the best, and it's got the lowest rate of inflation, a score of 100. And you can see that your country is 44% as good as West Germany. In the case of money supply, the United States has actually had in the last 12 months the lowest increase in money supply. This was up to December, these figures. And of course, that was one of the reasons that caused the stock market crash. There's just no money in the system. So that's potentially a good score, although it's caused a lot of problems we've got today. Interest rates. Switzerland have the lowest interest rates. As you can see, your interest rates are 73% is good. In the case of wages, you can see Canada's got the lowest increases in wages, and you're performing 61% as well. And when it comes to Switzerland, there's the current account deficit or surplus, it scores 100, you're scoring 26% as well. In trade balance, you can see Japan's got the best trade balance between imports and exports, and you're scoring 10% as well. In the case of imports, Switzerland is scoring the best. It has the most reserves to pay for imports. You're scoring 51% as well. And in gross national product, the country scoring the best is Australia, but I wouldn't take too much excitement about that because we're doing it with borrowed money. This perception of increasing your real wealth when you do it with borrowed money, I can make you look the richest person in the street by giving you another credit card. And that's effectively what Australia is doing by our foreign debt getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And therefore, if you look at that, those scores, the country scoring the best is Japan. The country scoring the next best is Switzerland. The next best is West Germany. And then we go down to Canada being the next best through to France. And then you can see all the same. United States, United Kingdom and Australia, basically on the same level. And what we have found over nearly 5 years of doing this, there is a direct correlation between those figures and the ultimate performance of your currency. And it's just logical. If you stop and think about it, if your economy is not performing well, the only way you can adjust your problem is to devalue your currency. And also, mark my words, no country in the world, and I say this quite emphatically, has ever got wealthier by devaluing its currency. And anyone that tells you it's good to readjust your currency to make you competitive is a dishonest politician. There's no country in the world, the only way of improving your real wealth is to work harder, having worked harder and more efficiently. It's the only way of improving real wealth. This country wants to get wealthier, and it wants to do it by working 35 hours or less, having 4 weeks annual leave, having 3 months long service leave after 10 years, 17.5% extra pay when you go on holidays, and double pay if you work on Saturday night, triple pay if you work on a long weekend. And I mean, it's a pass. And we want to be efficient. And we wonder why our manufacturing base has gone elsewhere. Therefore, in simple terms, the strongest currencies for the next 12 months, in my opinion, will be the Swiss franc, Deutsche Mark, and the yen. And I take this opportunity to say to you, I think one of the... rubbishing by the time I left him to say he's been attacking our country. I'm not. I'm just trying to put things into perspective, and please forgive me. But, one of the interesting things I observe by reading US writers and US commentators is there is a very consistent comment that the safest place to be is in US treasuries. And that's right through US advisors. But it is a safe place, but very, very, very few advisors after the crash should logically have told you to go in not into US treasuries, but into foreign currency. Because it was blatantly obvious that the effect on the... I lost a fortune on the stock market, but the next day when I lost it, I changed straight into Deutsche Mark and Swiss francs. And I picked up virtually everything I lost on the stock market. I lost $1.5 million on the stock market. So putting it in perspective, I felt it greatly, but I picked up virtually all of it by transferring to foreign currency. And I think... I don't care what anyone says. I think your currency, long-term, has had it until you go back to work. The Australian dollar, long-term, has had it until we go back to work. We do run a currency management service, a free plug for some of our services, which is nothing other. What we basically do is take that we use technical indicators, but to decide when to get in and out, but basically we take those three strongest currencies that we use in association with those economic data. Over the period of time, an account that started off at $30,000 in 1984, today has basically doubled. It's very conservative, it's a bank deposit type investment. But that is a service that we have which just basically looks for the strongest currencies. I think it should form part of everyone's portfolio. Okay, let's just summarise where I see the stock market going in 1988. To the best of my knowledge, in history, there has never been a major stock market collapse where the markets have not regained at least 50% of that loss prior to falling further. Therefore, we have sold our funds out of the US. We just weren't going to try and test it. It was there. We got out at about 1950 or 1970 on the index about a month ago. Mainly just a communication problem. I'm not telling you all to rush out. We have a problem with dealing far afield, particularly through US mutual funds. I don't know how you find internally getting money out of them, but from externally it's a, can be a very long process. Do you internally have problems?
A redemption problem?
Yeah, slight.
And the only problem we have is on October 19th, getting a phone call through to the fund that told me when to liquidate.
We tend to have some real problems. We do have dealt with a lot of them over the time, but they really, we tend to have some slow procedures and admin-wise. But I think the United States market, I think, you know, 2200 on the Dow as high as it'll go before it falls again, and I think where will it go to thereafter? I really don't know, but I don't think Brexit could maybe totally wrong in looking at 300 as a bottom sometime in the future. But I think it's got a lot way to go. And anyone that tells you we haven't entered into a bear market, you know, may be wrong. I may be wrong in saying we've entered a bear market, but history would tell me that it's absolutely certain we've entered into a bear market. Australia. I think the All Ordinaries Index here, which is around about the 1300 level, could recover to between 1500 and 1700, but I think thereafter it's down. In Southeast Asia, the Hang Seng's back up to nearly 2500, from this 4000 down to 1900. I think realistically it could go from 27 to 3000 before it goes back down again. In the European markets, probably of all the markets that deserve to do better than others, the European markets deserve to do well, and the currencies are sure to do well. We don't have a lot there because you can't hedge against losses, but we have about 5% of our client funds in Europe at this point in time. Because you've got a double-edged sword. Europe in itself has been well run, and their currencies are very strong, and based on that, I feel more confident in that market than most, but we've limited our exposure because of lack of hedging facilities. Japan, I think it's waiting for an accident. And I've been saying it for far too long, probably, and one day I'll be proved to be right. It's like Donald Hoppy, one day it's going to be right. But for 18 months, we've had our clients out of Japan. And look, they all got out with great profits. I wish we had them out of the other markets, too. But the fact is, we didn't. The amount of interest in the crash, our clients fell on average 15%, but every client has a different portfolio, that on average we wiped off 15%. Because I plainly simply expected it to crash. We've been forecasting for ages, but I expected it to be about a half in 1988. But I think Japan, anyone that's prepared to pay PEs of 60 and 70 for stocks, you know, to me it's just a manipulated market, and we know it's a manipulated market. It's published that it's a manipulated market. The Tonkian funds, the government tells them to manipulate the market if it's not going well. The housewives are buying the market. And really, I just think it's a market I'd stay well away from. Our rules, for anyone that's in the market, I think for 1988 it's blue chips only. I really believe if you own stocks like No Fine Gold or Midnight Oil or something like that, the fact is I think you'll be far better to liquidate those and go into decent stocks. In other words, if you hold some unknown gold mining stocks that you really don't know that's got ore under the ground and it's all speculation, I would be selling them and going into a top gold mining stock such as Homestake or Western Mining or whatever you want to go into. But I think it's a era for blue chips. And why I say it's an era for blue chips, the fund managers will go back into this market, but they'll only go back into blue chips. They know, and half of them that still only show price a week have just discovered that in a bear market you can't get rid of your stocks. So in the case of stocks, I seek blue chips. I think gold producers and real producers, if you want 10 or 15 or 20% of your portfolio there, that's fine. But if the market's got further to go, I'd be waiting to buy my gold stocks. Doesn't mean you shouldn't hold some bullion. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't buy Western Mining or any other well-known producer. But I think there'll be better times to buy them. And only time will tell. I have more to say about gold in a minute. I just can't make up my mind what it's doing. Most of the things out there will be very specific about the gold, so I think it's got me confused. I think if you're going to be in the market, then what we're saying to our clients, go in with either clearly defined stop losses if you're doing your own or portfolio insurance. And by the way, portfolio insurance is basically computer-controlled selling signals. Did that cause the crash? I don't believe it caused the crash at all. Because if you look at 1929, over 2 days we had exactly the same percentage fall as we had in October 19. So why did there were no computers in 1929? They had manual stop losses. So I don't, this banning computers, I don't think it have any effect on the market at all. And in fact, if you follow the, and I know Paul Welker's how it's written about it, but if you follow from August 29 through to October 29, and you marry that up with August 87, and you marry it up to October 19, the market falls are virtually identical all the way through it. And virtually day by day, just a few days out each time. So to suggest it was computers, I think, is someone trying to find an excuse. And probably governments, come out with some legislation to ban computers, governments leave forward and they get re-elected. Have more rules to control our lives. And you've got to watch the long-established trend. If you think I'm a cynic, you know I am. I used to have great faith in politicians when I was a child. Honestly, lost virtually 100% of respect. What's the long-established trend line? In the case of the Dow, if it breaks down below, say, 1600, it's broken a long-established trend line, and thereafter, the party's over. Who's doing cat with this day? Right. Stay talking for hours on this. As a matter of interest, though, we do have for our clients available, I think there's probably the only people around that do, or be anywhere in the world. We actually do have portfolio protected funds, mutual funds available for clients, including in Australia on the All Ordinaries Index, and the United States on the Standard & Poor's Index, and in Hong Kong it's only partially protected on the Hang Seng. And it's just against the index. But these funds are available, and they're designed on the basis that no matter what happens, there will be a break-even for the clients at the end of 12 months. So it's very conservative. They're about 50% in cash. But it means you do have the exposure to the market, and it means this year you may make nothing if the market keeps tumbling. But then next year you'll still be in the market, it keeps falling, and no one can pick the bottom of the market. So the big advantage is that sometime in the future, if the markets keep tumbling, you are there with part of your portfolio. And if you look at the real gains were made in 1932 to 1937, that's where the real gains are made. So somehow you want to try and have an exposure for when and if that market comes around.
So it was lower.
Looking at the stock markets, I said that I really don't see any great hope in the stock markets, but if you have an exposure through portfolio protection funds, or you've got very tight stop losses, and you're prepared to implement those stop losses. The beauty of portfolio protection, it happens automatically. There is no psychological decision-making process. And I guarantee every single person in this room who's honest has had stop losses and done nothing about them in the past. So unless you are so callous that you set that stop loss and how it gives you a level of getting out, unless you are so callous about getting out, and you just say to your stockbroker in advance, don't ring me, just sell when it reaches that point. Because I guarantee if he rings you, he'll either talk you out of it or you'll talk yourself out of it. Currencies, I told you the three strongest currencies, and that's where we would be having the money. In the case of interest rates are, in my opinion, particularly in the debt-ridden countries of, like Australia, New Zealand, United States and Canada and UK to a certain extent, very hard for interest rates to fall further. I mean, your country so desperately needs funds, and the only way it can raise them is by paying a sufficiently high rate on bonds to attract people to send money to. And, therefore, the likelihood of seeing any major drops in interest rates, I would think, are very unlikely, and the likelihood of higher interest rates in your country, great. There's only one thing, particularly in this country, interest rates could continue to drop because no one wants to borrow the money. So the banks are just absolutely flush, aren't they, John? I mean, they don't want to do it. And the bank could fall over himself, manager could fall over you, you know, and kiss your feet if you want to borrow money today because no one wants it. So, and of course, that's one of the other effects of why a recession will come, because no one wants it. So it is possible that interest rates will fall and continue to fall. So, you know, but I don't think anything significant, because ultimately interest rate is a reflection of the need for a country to borrow money. And, you know, there is no need for the strong countries to borrow money. They don't need it. It's a strong economy. But those of us who need the foreign countries to finance our problems, our lifestyle, which is all we're doing, obviously we've got to borrow money offshore. We've got to attract that money. The only way we can attract it is by paying a high enough interest rate. And you'd have to be a fool if you're a Swiss to lend to Australia or the United States at 2 or 3%. So basically, interest rates tend to be the differential in inflation rate between countries or the perceived risk. In the case of the property market, if we're going to have a recession, you know, property is still very popular around the world, and it tends to always be in cycles of stock market crashes. When a stock market crashes, property tends to move in its property moves after the stock market, and it continues to move for 12 to 18 months after the stock market. And I would expect that you would see in this country and in your country property to remain good for another 6, 12, 18 months. But don't expect any great capital profits. And don't forget, if you do hold a lot of property, and it's, especially if it's in debt and it's geared up, I think only a brave person would hold heavily geared property at this point in time. Now, if you own it and you don't mind about it falling in value, and a lot of people have, I don't know about how many Americans think real estate never falls in value. Is that a general, not in this audience, but is it a consensus among people? Yeah. 3 or 4 generations of increasing real estate prices? Yeah. This nation is full of people who think real estate never falls in value. Yet in the Great Depression, it fell 80%. I mean, there's plenty of people who can tell you stories that, you know, grandfathers you'll talk to in this country that ask people to take over their title if they pay the rates. So it's a myth if you really believe real estate just always goes up in value. If it's fully owned, you have far less problem. If it's freehold title, as long as your freehold title is more freehold than governments want us to have. In Australia, freehold title means you look after for the government to pay rates on until they want it. That's a fact. You know, freehold title here, our premier of this state is long gone now, but he decided he wanted the ore on the people's freehold land, which they had title to, so he just changed the law. Simple. And the last one is gold. I can't make up my mind here, but theoretically, for many years, for 20 years, our firm has been valuing gold on what we call intrinsic value. We have said with gold that and it's worked ad infinitum. It always comes back to its real value being the amount of paper money in the international banking system divided by the number of ounces of gold in the banking system. And interesting to see a former politician, Doug Anthony, really homed in on it by saying at the end there that gold would keep pace with the underlying value of currency. It was interesting to hear. It was, to me, it was almost a throwaway line. But the fact is, that's really what we're saying. And gold at the moment should be around 570 to 600 US dollars per ounce, if it was correctly valued. Therefore, you must question those of you who read Prechter. By the way, I have the utmost respect for Walt Prechter. He's an extremely nice man. He's also a man that has no self-opinionation at all. Those who claim he's wrong in the stock market, I don't believe they read his newsletter. He actually wasn't wrong. He just made a long-term forecast. But his forecast for gold, you know, is that it will fall below $200 an ounce. In our opinion, the only way that could happen would be mass deflation, mass repudiation of debt, mass reduction of money supply in the world. That's the only way it could happen. In the meantime, that is not occurring, and the real value for gold is around 550 to, or I think our figure at the moment is about $575 US an ounce. And we have found for, you know, year in, year out, it always comes back to that line. It goes too high, comes back down again. So I think that at this point in time, we don't have our clients in physical gold bullion. We perceive there is a better time, but I think sometime in the next few months, we'll certainly be recommending to our clients that they have some of their money in gold bullion of some kind. Now, whether that's physical gold bullion, or whether we manage it for them, we go in and out based on long-term trends of the actual metal, so you're there in a crisis. You know, not able to make super profits, being out of the dough if it does tumble. And finally, having an option for clients who want options trade against the gold so they can go and get an income from it. But I would think that part of your money you know, should be considered to be in gold bullion. I better start wrapping up, but in the case, why should you people invest offshore? I think it's imperative that every single person of high net worth invest some of their money overseas. I have a Singapore company, it is a non-tax avoidance company, it's fully disclosed, the Australian Tax Department know all about it. Why do I have it? For one simple reason only: when governments get into crisis, they will ban their citizens from investing offshore. It's the first thing to do. South Africa have done it. When you're in real crisis, the first thing you do is take measures that look politically good. It's very easy to stand up and have Ronald Reagan do an actor's speech to the citizens of America and say, you know, men and women of America, we have these horrible citizens who are sending their money out of the country, and for all of the goodwill of all people in this nation, we must keep the money here. And, you know, 99% of the voters say, yeah, here, here, good stuff, I totally agree. And the fact is that it's totally wrong, and it's just propping up an economy. So I would suggest that those of you who want permanent freedom from exchange controls, put some of your money offshore. Put it with an offshore manager, and, you know, it's a free plug for us, but we'd be delighted to talk to you if you're interested. But go to anyway, don't send all your money offshore, but maybe somewhere from 15, 20, 25, 30%, whatever you feel comfortable. But you also, unless you have reasonably high net worth, unless it's 40 or 50,000 US, you really shouldn't bother, because it's not large enough to be significant enough to pay the management costs to look after it. Diversification, I think, is imperative. I talked about that, and it's getting some of your money into a different manager's hands, into a different investment, into a different environment. Which countries would I recommend? I prefer the English-speaking countries. It's very convenient. I think Switzerland's a brilliant country. I love the country. It's terribly convenient sometimes for people not to be able to speak English. And I would prefer the democracies very similar to your own, being Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom, as being three places that have very similar laws and your moral standards. But Switzerland, obviously, has got to be one of the great countries in the world. And you've always got money in a crisis. Ladies and gentlemen, I've run out of time. If any of you would like to talk to me, if you'd like to, let me know, leave me your name as I walk out the door. I'll arrange for someone to talk to you. But I hope you got something out of it. I hope, on the other hand, that it at least made you think. If I depressed you, that's fine. If I did not attack your country, it's a beautiful place. I'll be there in a few weeks' time. It's a wonderful country. But I think sometimes it's good to hear how someone else perceives you economically. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, we get to tell the truth.
I didn't have time for that news, Paul.
And we manage the four insurance companies in Australia. In the Australian fixed interest markets, we find in our view that at this point in time, they are very attractive and provide attractive opportunities for US investors in particular. We have a very high running yield at the moment, especially in semi-government securities, which are AA or AAA rated. We have a very high yield differential between Australia and the United States, more particularly Australia and Japan, obviously, but still there's a large differential between Australia and...
I just haven't reinvested in so forth and just
left the same.
I don't know anything about it. You don't have any money coming in. Just let it ride.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks very much. Welcome to Sydney in Australia. It's 200th year in about 5 days, so you've come at a very good time. And that's been switched off. I wonder why that is. It was on the computer. The plug's been called. A few technical problems, sorry.
It's not that old, is it?
They're taller.
Thank you. Well, this is not unusual for me to have a few technical problems. Right. The reason why I have Skippy here is that Fran was very kind to provide me with Skippy when I did a talk to the Howard Rupp Convention in Orlando in Florida, and I couldn't bring that particular Skippy with me, so I bought a substitute. So he's one of our local natives to welcome you to Australia. Here is another one. We needn't talk about mining altogether, just a few things of interest here. I've brought two things to hand out. One is a series of notes, unfortunately handwritten, but that's okay. You can read my writing. I purposely tried to write clearly. And a compendium of notes on Australian mining. And the other one is what happened to the overseas markets in the world yesterday, because we're a day ahead of the United States. So this is where the state of the market is in London and New York. Yes. For those of interest. Now, that may have already been done or not, I don't know. What I propose to do, and hence I've got some maps up, is to very briefly go through what Australia's natural resources are, and mainly mining, locate them for you on the map, and then go through a series of slides to show you the selected commodities or resources, which are the more interesting ones, and show you where they are, what sort of conditions they're at, and how Australia rates in the world market. Now, a lot of course, the numbers are actually in those notes I've given to you. I had prepared, as you can see in handwriting, a whole lot of actual locations, companies, and tonnages, and all sorts of statistical figures, but I thought that would be like snowballing or an avalanche, and if you need to know any of those numbers and figures, then I can not only will I comment to them as we go, but you can ask me later should you wish to know them. Well, briefly then, Australia started 200 years ago by convicts, was the original settlers. Didn't take long, and we had some graziers, and of course we started off in here. This is a slight history lesson, and I will have some history in it from time to time. Sydney was the first place, and I went across the interior, and of course grazing spread and spread, and so hence we have grazing mostly on the east coast of Australia for sheep and wheat and cattle, in the interior for cattle, timber, and the forest belt, Tasmania, and fishing around the coast and so forth. You'll be happy to know that 4/5 of our population live in the belt there, mainly in the three cities of Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne, and the rest of the population is spread with Tasmania and the country, and Perth is a very fast-growing metropolis. Okay, so in Australia, in the natural resource terms, like I was saying, in sheep and wheat, $3 billion worth of exports. In wheat, $3.1 billion. Meat, which is mostly beef and mutton, $2.1 billion. Steel, $1 billion worth of exports, and sugar, $1 billion. Sugar, of course, is in the tropics. When it comes to mining and oil and gas, you can see for yourself the value of Australia's and ranking of Australia's production and reserves in that table of that, on the second page that I've given to you. I'll briefly outline for you now where some of these resources are. Bauxite, this area, and in here, in the tropics. Alumina is in also plants there, and plants scattered at Gladstone and Sydney, and here, and also here. There's other bauxite deposits here. These are the ones that are mined. There are bauxite deposits elsewhere that are not mined. In terms of coal, Australia's got a very vast coal basin here in Queensland called the Bowen, and another one here called the Sydney Basin in New South Wales. They're black coal, steaming and coking coals. In Victoria, there's a big basin of brown or lignite coal. Western Australia supplies itself from a small coal field. In terms of copper, the biggest copper mining operation is Mount Isa, and it's one of the largest in the world. By sheer coincidence, Right next door to it, within several hundred metres, is the one of the world's also largest lead, zinc, silver deposits. So the one company has two ore deposits side by side. Diamonds. Australia is a world leader in diamond production coming from the Kimberleys area. It surpassed South Africa in terms of carat output. Gold. Australia is the third ranking, depending on whether you throw the USSR in or not. But South Africa, USSR, and then Australia with over 100 tons per year of gold, and then it buys with Canada and USA. And gold is more or less right throughout Australia, originally being discovered here, and in an anti-clockwise method was the early discoveries and the new discoveries of Western Australia. We'll go into that later. Iron ore, the iron ore province, this area in Australia, untold quantities lasting well into the next centuries. Lead, zinc, silver, major mining production of that is at Mount Isa and also Broken Hill. Mineral sands, New South Wales along the coastline, the government has locked in over $1 billion worth of mineral sands that cannot be mined. In Queensland, there are areas of mineral sand mining along the coast and on islands. Western Australia, it's in this area and a further one slightly further north or onshore. In terms of oil and gas, you can see it better on that map. Oil and gas bearing basins. The main ones in Australia are in this area, the Cooper Basin, which supplies oil and gas to Sydney, Adelaide, and oil also for production and treatment at a new place called Point Bonython. There are also oil gas production here offshore West Australia and other basins in this area which produce gas, and also in Queensland coming to Brisbane. Natural gas pipeline almost goes a third of the continent to supply Sydney. Platinum. Australia does not mine platinum per se. It's a byproduct of Western Mining's nickel operations at Kambalda. But there is very active platinum exploration in Australia, and with the right pricing and after feasibility studies, a mine could develop. Phosphate in Queensland is taking the place of rock phosphate deposits from bird dung in the Pacific and Indian Oceans. You've heard of Christmas Island and Nauru and countries like that. Tin. Australia did have a large alluvial tin production in this area in Queensland. Main tin production at the moment is Hard Rock Underground here, one of the largest tin mines in the world in terms of underground hard rock tin mining. And also tin is mined at a place called Greenbushes in Western Australia, also both alluvial, and there is a hard rock deposit there, but it's mainly alluvials. Tin is smelted there and it's the only smelter currently operating in Australia. Uranium. Australia has amongst the world's largest uranium deposits. Jabiluka was the biggest single deposit in the world. Over 200,000 pounds of contained uranium in Arnhem Land area here. There's two mines there being worked. One has been mined out and is actually being milled at the present time. The other one is currently being mined. And there's a great new development in this area in South Australia called Roxby Downs or Olympic Dam, which will be a huge uranium, gold and copper mine. We also mine antimony, New South Wales, bismuth, comes from Turnham Creek, cobalt, byproduct of a few other minerals, garnet from the coast here, lithium from Greenbushes, kaolin, which is a source of China clay and paper, clays that go into paper and ceramic and products like that in Victoria and elsewhere, molybdenum, byproduct of other mining, salt, vast salt mines in here for mainly caustic soda method extraction. Tantalite, which is a computer space age or strategic modern mineral for the future. Talc, tungsten, you can practically name it, and Australia has it or mines it. Cobalt also, yes. It's a byproduct, not a particular mining product as such. I think that's about it in terms of where things are. Like I was saying, details, more specifically companies, numbers and so forth, I can go through you. But rather than bore you with that, I think if you want to know those things, asked me afterwards, what I'd like to do now is to ask if the light's going to be slightly dimmed, and I'll take you through a kaleidoscope of Australia in terms of areas. I'll point out from time to time where we are, and also the various commodities, how they're mined, what conditions they're in, and I hope you enjoy the show. It's another Australian native just to greet you and get you comfortable. Certainly the baby is. And there is another Australian native who was here before the white fellows came. And we all arrived in these tall ships 200 years ago. But coal is indeed, if you have a look at that table, is our biggest income earner at the present time, over $5 billion worth. We in fact mine about 120 million tonnes a year, use about 30 million tonnes, 10 million is in a stockpile, 85 million tonnes are exported. We are the largest exporter of coal in the world, surpassing the United States. Half of it roughly is steaming coal that goes up in furnaces for electricity generation, and the other half is in coking coal for the production of iron ore and steel. This is one of the coal mines down the south coast. The early mines were underground. These are the modern methods using modern machines. I wouldn't want to be a coal miner in particular. Coal gets washed. This is one of the new technologies being produced. You may not be able to see it properly, but that's the cutting tool of a longwall mining unit, which makes coal mining extremely efficient. And the miners didn't like it because the team of 11 could be reduced to a team of 4, so they compromised and took 7 people to operate one of those machines and 4 could play cards while the other 3 worked. Didn't take long, and we developed these what we call open cuts, or in the United States, strip mines, and they're quite extensive in Queensland. I hope you probably can see the map here in Queensland, and also in some of the newer Hunter Valley mines. And it's a very simple operation. Just blast the coal and operate it into a truck after you remove the overburden with this great big drag line. And they're big, 100-ton buckets. And we got some big strip mines. You can imagine one of these worth $30 million. Is that in focus? That's a bit better. I've stood inside one of those buckets and the lip is still as far above me. Of course, the coal gets treated, washed, sorted out, and then stockpiled ready for, as you can see, reclamation. And then that gets loaded onto ships from the Port of Newcastle, ships such as this, up to 100 tonnes. Or sometimes bigger, and then of course from Newcastle and elsewhere it goes to Japan and the United States and other places. And that was the port of Waratah, named after this flower, which is a native. Alright, so we also have sheep. Australia used to ride on the sheep's back, and it's wool, which is the other natural commodity. Well, those graziers took their sheep across the Blue Mountains. I don't know if you get a chance to go up there, but it's west of Sydney, this sandstone dividing range. Terrific place. And it was up there where they first discovered gold. In this very place here, it's called Ophir, the junction of Lewis Ponds and Summer Creek, just north of Bathurst. And some of the local inhabitants still are around. It's a platypus. But everybody was after gold, and it was originally alluvial panning gold that was recovered. And that kicked on the start of the Australian mining boom. It was Lawrence Hargraves who made the first commercial discovery there, not the first person to report the finding of gold, because that was a reverend clergyman. He reported that to the governor, and the government says, please do not make that public, it'll start a stampede that we don't want. But Lawrence Hargraves had no problems about that, having been in California in 1849. So, after the alluvial mining operations of the panners and the cradle washers, and you've seen drawings of the early operations, sometimes they start to get a bit bigger. We have the actual gravels and the sands in a river valley that can be accessed by excavators, a bit better than pick and shovels and Chinese labour gangs, so forth. And to take the place of the water rockers and so forth, you have these modern trommels and agitators and so forth. And here's another one within another area. You can see how neatly they can scrape the banks and take fairly much every piece of gold that's there up to grades of well under half an ounce, a half a 0.5 grams per ton. Perhaps I should show you that and just briefly mention that all it does is go through there, it gets washed inside, all the big rocks come out at the bottom, and the gold comes down on these weekly tables and gets collected. And of course it's impure and gets melted and collected and put into bars and so forth. This is an oil deal operation in Western Australia in the northwest on a much bigger scale. You can see how red the country is in many places. This is actually quite green in terms of the grass and the spinifex and the trees. They've had a good rainfall that particular year. Similar, same area. Again, the kind of trommel and the collection services mechanised with those trucks. Australian gold mining, as you can see, it was reported earlier by the chap from the Gold Corporation. The first peak, Australia led the world in terms of tonnage. You can see there, 75 million tonnes. And again, at the turn of the century, when Kalgoorlie was established. And then, now, the third gold rush. Well, this gentleman here, his name's Paddy Hannum. He discovered Kalgoorlie in 1893, I think it was. So this is Kalgoorlie, the largest gold mining centre in Australia. I hope I'm not stealing Ron's thunder too much by showing him a few slides of his home patch. But that's the town. The town is actually twin towns of Kalgoorlie, and Boulder hardly ever gets mentioned, but I'm going to mention it. The Golden Mile doesn't take care of encompass Mount Charlotte, but it's the Fimiston area here. And these are just a couple of extended views of the Kalgoorlie area. You can get a little bit of an idea of how mismatched it was. But that's an organised mess. It's a pity that you don't stay in focus. Anyway, treatment plant there. Kalgoorlie is becoming one great big open pit. In fact, Alan Bond wants to create the world's super biggest pit, and he's well on the way to doing that, having taken over the North Kalgoorlie Company and also the next door to it, the Paringa Mining Company's. I think of the name in the half a sec, and one or two other leases, and made it into one great big conglomerate. This is the Mount Charlotte area with the new shaft here being developed by Western Mining Company on behalf of Kalgoorlie Mining Associates, which Alan Bond has now taken over also. So he virtually controls the Golden Mile these days. Homestake is still there with its 48%. Used to be Western Mining controlled. It still probably is managed by Western Mining, but Alan Bond has got the gold mines of Kalgoorlie stake. And he also bought out Poseidon. Those names may not mean too much to you, but the Golden Mile, in fact, is that mile that way, and this is just an extension of it. And the first discovery was at Mount Charlotte, and later on the bigger discovery was at Fimiston, but Paddy Hannum didn't do that.
Are there environmental concerns about replacing it?
In Western Australia, no. In Queensland, no. Those governments are the best ones in terms of the mining industry. Victoria is the worst. New South Wales is okay. Tasmania is on the side of the miners also. If you put all the mining areas in Australia all together, every one of them, you could put it in an area less than a pinprick on that map. Looks great in aerial size, but Australia is such a vast country that in actual fact it's big, and the overall impact doesn't have much, although the government has very big say in some cases, like the controversial minerals such as uranium. That's one of the new treatment plants at Ajaroya on the southern end of Kalgoorlie. Well, okay, so this just briefly gives you an idea of... popped out of focus again. But just a matter of mineralisation coming up along fault zones and being controlled by these various fissures in the earth, and they being very rich products which are being mined. That's very simple in terms of an explanation, but it gives you an idea of why it's such a bonanza deposit. Well, the Kalgoorlie area, of course, was a staging post for many other mining developments in the area further north, as you can imagine, particularly in not only in the rush of the 1890s, but also in the rush of the 1980s. And it's almost fair and reasonable to say that every new mine now is the redevelopment of an existing old mine. And that's the case at this particular place called Paddington. It used to be mined in those days, it was re-mined in 1930s. It's re-mined again now as an open cut because of the new technology being able to extract ore, which is now economic at much lower grades. So this is what's happened. This one is at Reedy's in its early stage. That will become a big open pit. It's almost the case that all of this won't be treated. The central core will be, so there is some waste that's removed. But virtually all this stuff will end up going through a plant. And you get the start of them, such as this one. And it's very simple stuff. You can see how weathered the rock is. It's so soft you can crumble it with your hands. This bulldozer doesn't need a drill to blast it. It can literally just rip it apart with its own blade. It's all, most of these rock types are basalts and dolerites, which are, if you can think of it as very fine, well, you probably know what they are, fine-grained volcanic. And it's so simple, just a backhoe, load it into a truck and take it to a pit. Get down a bit further and drilling or at least pneumatic hammering may be necessary, but as you can see, all he needs there is that backhoe. Now, they're the new, what you've just seen are the new suite of mines, the Sons of Gwalia, the Wim Creek, Meekatharra, the Matana, the Reedy's mine at Matana, Fort Matana, and so on. There's a whole lot of Paddington, a whole lot of names and places and companies that are doing that. In some instances, old mines, this particular one happens to be the tailings dump at Norseman, for Central Norseman Gold, one of the large established miners, just showing you the size of it there. In some instances, like for instance at Horseshoe Lights and at Sons of Gwalia itself, some of these dumps can be retreated because they're now economic and they become ore bodies once again. And the plants are very, very generally speaking, goes through a series of tanks, leaching, and a new process called carbon pulp, and very low grades up to, down to about 0.2 of a gram can be recovered. It's thirsty work. Gives you an idea of one of the outback pubs. This one's closed. I wonder if it had no beer that day. That was in Queensland, so just to refresh you where Queensland is, it's the northeastern block of Australia, and this series of slides will show you the development of a brand new mine called Kidston, and this is Australia's, up until right currently, well, let's assume it still is, it is the largest single mine in Australia. Doesn't produce the largest quantity of gold from one plant because the Kambalda Kalgoorlie Western Mining Operations does that, but they draw on several ore bodies. This is Australia's at the present time the largest single mine.
What's the name of it?
Kidston in Queensland. Now, it took over from Telfer in Western Australia as the largest single mine. It's owned by Kidston. Listed on the Australian Stock Exchange, and that company is, its parent company is Placer of Canada, or Placer Pacific, which is also listed here. Shows you a few development pictures. I'm sorry about this jumping out of focus all the time. It's most annoying. It's a hard rock mine, as you can see, in the sense that the rock here is not weathered and crumbly as much. On the east coast of Australia, the rocks are weathered still, but not as much or as deeply as they are in Western Australia, hence its blasting. But they also tend to be, generally speaking, a bit lower grade but higher tonnages. Kidston, the top of my head, numbers on it about 57 million tonnes, and the grade's about 3.5, 3.8, something like that. Well, in fact, it might be lower than 2.8. The final result of it all is that the gold gets smelted after it's collected from the carbonate pulp, and in these ingots, that's what it's all about in production of the gold. Well, those companies that are mining gold are laughing all the way to the bank, because currently the price of gold, $475 American, and an exchange rate at 0.70 means it's over $600 Australian an ounce, and the cost of mining is about $300 an ounce. Now, those figures vary a little bit from each individual mine, but there's a good 100% profit margin, rule of thumb speaking. So gold mining is the industry to be in, and is doing very well in Australia. And of course, to be in that, some of the early prospectors, they were looking around the place for how to find these gold mines, and they found a leader, and they dig it in, they tunnel, and they open the cut. And the early prospectors dug holes all over the place. And that's how it was done in the early days. And it became like rabbit warrens, if you like, or gophers, as you probably know of in the United States. And some of those diggings paid off, some didn't. And in more modern times, the exploration companies, they just dug these huge trenches and they sample them and have a geologist go down them, and I've been down these kind of things. And you do detailed mapping and take samples, and the laboratory tells you whether there's any gold there or not. And in other cases, they do these geophysical surveys or an aerial survey. And then you come to a stage where you go and start drilling for it. You can drill by all sorts of methods, like that truck-mounted one, tractor-mounted one, or a pneumatic driller like this one. Looks a bit like a... or you have this reverse circulation, which is the new vogue thing. This thing goes down and punches the dirt, and all the dirt gets collected in these bags and gets sampled. Or a more refined method would be to use diamond core, when the end result of it all is the geologist or prospector or driller, they still pan for gold because it's still reliable. You can see the colours. And some of that leads to these particular finds, and they get developed, like I was saying earlier, in various remote countries, areas. Both these two slides show early on the development of two new gold mines. This particular one is the Stara prospect in Queensland. It'll be a major gold mine in the future. And all found by dry diamond drilling, which determines what there is underground. And from that, the geologists and statisticians determine the ore and the reserve and the mining method and so on and so forth. Those rocks get cut up in thin sections. They can find out the assays from both those and actual chemical methods. And if there's gold there, because there's gold in Endar rocks, one of the locals looks on. And that's what gold mining is about in Australia.
Were those sections magnified at the last
couple of shots? Yes, they were thin sections, which means that it was a particular piece of rock which sliced very thinly and then placed under a microscope, and that way the rocks become transparent and you can actually see through them, or use reflective light, and they all have their particular characteristics, which determines what the rocks and minerals are. It's a fascinating aspect of laboratory geology and so on. Well, getting onto something harder than gold, iron ore. I show you where Australian iron ore deposits are. This one was one of the early ones, and that's what founded the steel industry. You'll notice that Broken Hill Proprietary Limited, Australia's largest company, started off mining silver, then zinc at Broken Hill, and gave that up around the turn of the century when it moved to Lithgow west of Sydney and started to treat iron ore and steel. Then later it moved to Whyalla and Newcastle and became Australia's largest and only steel producer. It no longer is in Broken Hill at all, but the name it retained. So this is what some of the iron ore bodies look like. Mountains and mountains of iron ore. One could almost say pure mountains of rust, because that's almost what it is. The assays of iron is there over 50%. You know, it's about 52% if it's hematite, 64% if it's magnetite, and about 38% if it's limonite, depending on what formation it is. And these are some of them. Just that mountain is solid iron, just about. You can see the dark blackness, the heaviness of it, and they literally, those benches just get mined. As you can see, it's very simple. They just pattern drill it like that, and like that. There is the drill there. He's actually almost finished his scoop run of the soft material that's been shattered by the blast. These deposits are the Hammersley ones, Mount Newman, largest ones in Australia. Australia, Hammersley, about 50 million tonnes a year, Mount Newman, a bit more, and the third one is Goldsworthy, 38. And the final result is they end up in big boilers and they come out as iron, big iron, and steel. And that's done at Newcastle and also at Port Kembla. And used to be in Kwinana in Western Australia, but that's been closed down. So there's really only Whyalla is the third operating steel producer in Australia, in South Australia. So we have a large steel and iron ore mining industry. That's a bottle brush. Yeah. Alright, so batteries, lead used to be used in plumbing. These days it's still used a lot in cars, and of course that's the main reason why we're still after lead. So lead mining, here it is. It's also an additive in petrol, as you know, stock knocking. Beg your pardon?
Not in paint anymore.
Not in paint, you said. Yeah, I think you're right. Well, this is a couple of slides of Mount Isa, Australia's largest lead mine. And in fact, the theme is lead, but all the photographs are not of Mount Isa. This one is of Rosebery in Tasmania. Another one in Rosebery. That's a vertical photograph. Using modern machines, they just drill out the rock, which is extremely hard, place the gelignite in there, and then at the end of the shift, bang. Then they recover it with trucks and stuff. They bolt the roof if it's needed.
How's that done?
They just drill a hole in the roof, and that hole then... These holes are drilled in the roof one by one, and they're about 2 metres long, 6 feet, and then a rod is placed in it, and that rod is then screwed. And as it's screwed, it pushes through the centre of it and expands the end. So the end is, in fact, forced outwards, holding onto the rock 6 metres within. And it's got the plate on the edge as well. And that holds any problem. If there's any loose rock, it'll hold it up. And they really work. I've seen a terrific demonstration of those rock bolts holding up loose rock. And they come out of trains like this, from these porthole declines or shafts, whichever it happens to be. And they go into these, I'm so annoyed about having to focus this thing all the time, into these plants where it gets frothed up, which is an Australian invention. And that frothing separates the mineral from the gangue, and you have a concentrate of lead or zinc, which can then be smelted into metal. And that's done in Australia as well. And you can tell different colours. That one's zinc, that one's lead. Bubbles, toll, froth and fubble, or whatever that saying went, and gets smelted.
and you have those ingots as I showed you. That one's called Australian Wattle. And this is an aerial view of Mount Isa, which is, like I was saying, copper ore body this area, lead ore body that area, the old open cuts behind. It's one of the largest mines in the world, certainly the largest silver mine in the world, but silver is merely a byproduct. And here shows you how large this one is underground. They can take down these huge machines, drill and blast and carry, all trackless. This is a modern mine, has no railway underground at all. All these dump trucks, etc. Water down there for cooling gets extremely hot, 1 degree every 100 feet in temperature rise as you go down. Modern shafts, you can see this, the winder is actually on top of the shaft here. The shaft itself has got 2 levels, 16 men each level, and next to that it's got the ore carrying shaft, so in fact there's 2 separate shafts within the one. It's a huge operation by any standards of the world. And the final product becomes this raw or rough copper, which then later on gets, in electronic baths, gets purified in Townsville, in the case of Mount Isa. And just as a last throw-in for copper, this is a view of Mount Lyell in Tasmania, where they actually had copper smelters in the old days on site, and all this fume, sulfur dioxide gas caused with the rain, caused acid rain, and the whole landscape is actually a moonscape. There's not a shred of vegetation on the whole mountainside. Just sort of throw that in. The locals, every time a new blade of grass grows, the locals throw it out or pick it up because they want to retain a beautiful tourist viewpoint. No vegetation. I was there actually less than a week ago. I just came back from holidays, and you might notice I've forgotten the race plate. Saw the tall ships in Hobart before they left there, and I actually had a look at Mount Lyell just less than a week ago. Nice place. Good to visit. I wouldn't want to live there. Well, mineral sands, another one of Australia's major exports. Used to have 85% of the world market, now it's down to 50. They are the mineral sands, ilmenite, which is titanium oxide with water in it, zircon, zirconium silicate, rutile, titanium oxide without water, and there's one missing called monazite, which has rare earths. And they're mined, like I was saying before, on the western coast of Australia and also on the Queensland to New South Wales strip around there, although New South Wales government in its wisdom has frozen in our northern areas. Used to be done on the beaches, some of them done in the hinterland. I'll just run a few through these a little bit faster and show you that they were originally mined by dredging methods, as you can see, stockpiles, and later on they would land stripping areas of former beach lines and sand dunes. And that goes through treatment plants, roughly tables, and they get separated out mechanically, wet by wet methods, and then by electrostatic and magnetic methods, and so upgraded in these kilns. And the end product is titanium, which is a pigment and used for paints.